It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. We are going to be talking about baseball this half hour. And actually, I have a bit of breaking news. I was just handed a press release from the Major League Baseball organization. Commissioner Bud Selig announced today that Milwaukee Brewers outfielder Ryan Braun has been suspended without pay for the remainder of the 2013 championship season and postseason for violations of the basic agreement on joint drug prevention and treatment. Braun says he acknowledges his mistakes and is looking to get back to the game he loves. So that's an issue we'll probably be talking about more on the Ideas Network in the next day or two. Now, looking back at some baseball tradition and some happier news here in Wisconsin. In just a few minutes, we're going to look at the art of baseball scoring.
Many people are calling that a dying art, but our guest says not so fast. Despite the prevalence of digital apps and distractions, the hobby lives on for many dedicated baseball fans.
First, we're going to take a look at some baseball that's happening closer to home. If names like Mallards, Moondogs, and Honkers mean anything to you, chances are you're a fan of the Northwoods League.
Well, the league just wrapped up the first half of their season, and their All-Star game takes place tomorrow night in Eau Claire.
According to our next guest, the Northwoods League features local high-quality baseball while preserving some of the game's and the state's history.
Wisconsin Public Radio's own Terry Bell is a huge fan of the Northwoods League, and he's with us now to tell us what it's all about.
Terry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No, it's great to be here.
Now, for people not familiar with the Northwoods League, give us a 101. What's it all about?
Sure. A lot of people call it a minor league, and that's technically not really true. This is summer collegiate baseball. These are players who play for colleges and universities around the country during the regular school year, typically the spring. In the summer, they're allowed to play for these teams around the country. There's about 40 leagues like this, and they can play on these teams as long as they're not paid.
And do some of these players, once they get out of college, graduate from this league into the professional system, into a minor league team?
Oh, quite a bit of these players are drafted by Major League Baseball, absolutely.
Any famous ones from the Wisconsin area or from the Northwoods League
in general? I'd say the biggest star right now is Max Scherzer. He used to play for the La Crosse Loggers, and now he's the ace of the Detroit Tigers staff.
All right.
Yeah.
And the All-Star game this week, what's going on with that?
It's a pretty traditional format. If you've seen the Major League All-Star game, you'll pretty much know what's happening up in Eau Claire on Tuesday night. They're going to play at Carson Park, which, personally speaking, is one of the most beautiful and historic small baseball parks I've ever seen. And it'll be the Northern Division versus the South Division. About 50 or so of the best players in the league will be playing in Eau Claire.
Now, you might think of this as it's not even minor league, it's sub-minor league, but...
But
communities, fans, they're really into this.
Well, what makes the Northwoods League really terrific is most of these other leagues, they're played on high school fields. And maybe you'll get a few dozen people to come out and watch, and they'll pass the hat to maybe raise some money. And the teams are run as nonprofits. The Northwoods League is different because these are played in minor league stadiums that were around Wisconsin and Minnesota, like in the 50s and 60s and even in the 30s and 40s. And over the course of, say, the 60s, 70s, and 80s, these professional affiliated minor league teams went away, and these great ballparks like Carson Park in Eau Claire and Athletic Park in Wausau and Witterfield in Wisconsin Rapids and Wade Stadium in Duluth, I could go on and on, but they kind of sat either empty or underutilized for a couple of decades until the middle of the 1990s, the Northwoods League came along. Basically, a former minor league executive decided, here's a business opportunity. We could do a summer collegiate league in these old minor league parks. Instead of running them as nonprofits, we can run them as businesses. And what the fans get and players get is a professional experience. And it's like going out to the ballpark the way it used to be, where the community is rallying around these teams.
That's great. It's like this lost experience that's been resurrected with these leagues in these old parks.
I really feel that way.
And you go to these games. What's the experience like? I mean, people might be familiar with going to a big league game and the big crowd and the, you know, the overpriced beer and things like that. What is it like? What's it like to be at these games?
It's a lot of fun. I live in Madison, of course, so I see a fair number of Mallards games. And there's a really good buzz in the air. You get about 5,000, 6,000 people, and it's a lot of fun. And a lot of the teams, a lot of the other parks are smaller. You get maybe 2,000 or 3,000 at some of them. It's still a lot of fun in Wisconsin Rapids. They can generate a lot of noise because of the canopy that covers the grandstand, really traps a lot of the noise. So 1,200 people in Rapids can make a lot of noise. But they have a lot of contests and shenanigans happening between innings. Really what it is, in addition to pretty good baseball, is an affordable night out for the family. That's what they're selling as much as. I mean, in Wausau, you can get a seat behind home plate for $6, $7.
Now, you've seen games around the league. You've been to a lot of the different stadiums, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Any you haven't been to that's that are on your list?
I would love to see a Wade Stadium in Duluth. That is a really impressive building. Carson Park is a personal favorite of mine. It's just so beautiful and historic. And Hank Aaron had his first minor league assignment there. And there's a great setting outside that pays tribute to Hank Aaron. There's a statue of him and a Hall of Fame that's local. And that's a neat experience. Madison is really something else. Madison, they get such big crowds that they outdraw many minor league teams over the course of a season that play twice as many home games.
There's a hunger for baseball out there, for markets that don't have a big stadium.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I think in this day and age, too, you get people who are maybe a 2-3 hour drive from Milwaukee or the Twin Cities. Mm-hmm. They don't necessarily want to invest all of that time and all that money into a Brewer game or a Twins game. But within 2 hours or less, there's a Northwoods League team, and a lot of families are finding this to be a great alternative.
All right, let's be the sports network now. We're headed into the All-Star break. Mm-hmm. Who are the teams to beat this year in the Northwoods League?
Well, in the South Division, and that's what I can speak most intelligently about, the Madison Mallards wrapped up the first half championship. The Lakeshore Chinooks, last I checked, were in first place for the second half championship, and that's how they divide them up. It's really neat because at the midpoint of the season, you declare one champion, but you still have every team back in contention right away for the second half championship.
Oh, okay. So Even if you're just in the cellar out of the first, it's
the last
it's a clean
place
slate.
Team. Yeah, exactly. It's a clean slate starting with the second half.
I got to admit, Terry, after all these years, I still haven't been to a Mallards game, to any of the Northwoods games. Give me a pep talk. Get me to bring my family there.
Well, you know, it's you can get your whole family in rather affordably. It's a lot of fun. There are a lot of diversions for the kids and a lot of distractions, too, for people who are not necessarily baseball fans. I've always said of all the spectator sports, baseball is the best one for the non-fan or the casual fan because you're still outside on a beautiful summer night with a great crowd of people that's in a great mood. And, you know, what's better than that?
And before we're done, Terry, let me ask you about the future of the league. Anything big coming up?
There's going to be some expansion next year. The league has been at 16 teams for a number of years. And next year, there is going to be a new team in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and also a new team in Kenosha. And Kenosha is a great story because they have an historic park there, Simmons Field. One of the All-American Girls Baseball League teams was there back during World War II. If you saw the movie A League of Their Own, you'll know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And it'll be exciting to see a high level of baseball back at Simmons Field.
What's the next game you're going to? Do you have a plan?
I am probably going to go to I don't really have a plan, actually. Okay. But I will get to one soon.
Great. Terry, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
Terry Bell is Wisconsin Public Radio's Morning Edition host. And if you'd like to hear more from him, he'll have an interview with Madison Mallards President Vern Stenman coming up tomorrow during Morning Edition.
Coming up next, get out your scorecards and pencils. We'll be talking about the art of baseball scoring and why, for some fans, there's nothing that compare. And, Gene, we'll try not to get a K on this interview.
I'll tell you what, I don't even know what that means, but it sounds great to me. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. This is Central Time.
We'll pick up our baseball thread now and look at a part of the game that some people think is going the way of the dinosaur. When there are so many things to distract us at the ballpark, does baseball scoring and stat keeping still matter to fans?
Well, our next guest says sports writers have been noting the ever-waning popularity of pencil and paper scoring at the ballpark for decades. But for dedicated fans, the hobby is still strong, and we'd like to hear from you. Do you score baseball games the old-fashioned way, or do you have some memories of games past with Mom, Dad, or Grandpa keeping score? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org.
Henry Fetter is a sports, business, and culture blogger for The Atlantic. He recently wrote a piece called By Hand Baseball Scoring, A Dying Art That May Never Actually Die. We've got a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page. Henry, welcome to Central Time.
My pleasure.
Now, I remember doing this. I would sit at home watching TV, and I had the flip book, and I would stat out each play, and I played the APBA baseball card game. It was like Status Pro Baseball, and I scored games like that, too. What's your first memory? Did you do this as a kid?
I remember very well trying to learn how to keep score, or at least the rudiments of it, from my father. And I did also play APBA, and we kept score
All right.
records. But I have to say, and this is what provoked my piece, that, as you noted, score-keeping at the ballpark has been reported to be dying for decades. And I have to say, my earliest memories are that there were actually very few fans at the ballpark keeping score, even in the so-called golden age of scoring.
Now, let's talk about what we're talking about a little bit. You've got this big sheet showing a bunch of baseball fields, and if I ground out to second and he throws it to first, I'm out. I show it's 4-3, right, if I'm remembering the numbers. The 4 is the second baseman. The 3 is the first baseman.
That is correct.
If I get a single, I draw in a little line, and I do that for each and every batter throughout the game.
As best one can, I think it's inevitable, as I noted, that you'll miss a play or two.
There's a code for that, isn't there, that somebody came up with?
Well, it's attributed to Phil Rizzuto. WW wasn't watching. And he was being paid to watch the game. So I think a fan who misses a play can be excused, and it's inevitable.
Now, what is the joy of this? What's the fun for a fan in keeping these detailed stats?
I think it's a way to be involved in the game, to have your own record. And you have a nice souvenir at the end of the game. I have on the wall of my den my scorecard from Game 6 of the 1975 World Series, and it's fading a bit over the decades, but that's my personal memento of the game in which Carlton Fisk hit that memorable home run. So I think you have something tangible. I think it keeps you focused on the game in a way that you might not be otherwise. And I guess I could also say it's part of the tradition of going to a baseball game, even if the tradition has been somewhat romanticized.
And now you said this isn't necessarily a dying art. It's always been something that kind of a smaller number of people have done.
Well, I think that's what caught my eye, that there have been a series of articles in recent years. They seem to appear at the time of the All-Star Game, which is when baseball likes to celebrate traditions. And it occurred to me that one of the traditions, not being celebrated but being noted, is that scorekeeping is dying. And I remember when I was researching my book, reading many back issues of the Sporting News, that I had seen an article in 1950, the headline of which was, "Few fans actually keep score." So if something has been dying for 65 years, it may be premature to declare it dead. But I think it also shows that the idea that 50, 60, or 70 years ago, the ballpark was filled with dedicated fans clutching pencils to their scorecards, recording every play, is something of an exaggeration.
Then as now, there were a bunch of people probably sitting and drinking beer and watching the game, only the beer was cheaper, probably.
Well, the beer was certainly cheaper, and so were the scorecards.
That's true. That's an obstacle. There's a cost of entry now, right? You can't just buy a scorecard. You have to get the whole program now? Is that right?
Well, that's been true for, I think, 20 or 30 years even. I remember first going to a ball game in the late 1950s, early 1960s, and you could buy a scorecard. It might be 15 cents or 20 cents. And it would be customized for the game. It would actually have the home team, but the visiting team would be identified as that day's visiting team. Mm-hmm. There'd be a little brief section next to each player, their up-to-date statistics. And sometime in the 1960s, I think, clubs switched to glossy program books in which a scorecard was inserted, but it was a generic scorecard, not customized to that day's game. Now, I had a very heartening experience recently. I went to a ball game in Washington at the Washington Nationals' wonderful new ballpark, and the scorecards were available for free. And that may be one way of encouraging more people to keep score, although I must report that, at least in my section, I was keeping score and maybe one or two other people were keeping score. But it does seem odd that in an era when a ticket to the game costs $50 or $100 or even more, that the ball club can't throw in a complimentary scorecard.
That piece of paper will really set them way back.
It might be the difference, right? Preventing them from signing a free agent, correct.
Sure. We've got some callers. Let's go to Matt in Sun Prairie now. Hi there, Matt.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
Great. I've been keeping score for a long time. I was born in 1971. I'm 42 years old, and it's very interesting, like your guest said, it keeps you connected to the game. It's great looking back at those old lineups, the old names that you know. My original sheets, I would redo them in the winter, and it was out and hits and out and hits, and it's evolved over time. And now I, as I mentioned too, keeping track of the game, I just have a piece of paper, and you scribble down the things, scribble down what happens during the game, and then when it's done, you have a very interesting piece of art when you are finished. Even now, I keep track of my son's games, and he's 10, and in 20 years, he will hopefully get those and appreciate those. That was a game when he was in Little League. That's what he did when he was a young boy. My wife, in the worst way, wants me to get rid of these file folders of games I have in our basement, but I have a hard time relinquishing that. It's kind of like you're letting up your past. You're letting your past go. It's a really enjoyable thing.
Matt, if you need some backup, have her give me a call. I'll advocate for you keeping those there in the basement.
I will definitely. And I will too. All the help I can get.
Thanks a lot, Matt. Well, what do you think about that, Henry?
Well, if Matt is 42 years old, I guess there are another 40 or maybe 50 years of scorekeeping ahead of us. And I think what he says exactly jives with my experience. And I think it is true that one's scorekeeping can become more sophisticated over time. And you do have a memento that is irreplaceable and unique to you. And the idea of annotating the scorecard with your personal reflections or notes is a valuable one. And on my scorecard from that 1975 World Series game, I have my little annotations and it's a unique piece of baseball history, if I may be so bold, or personal baseball history.
We'll go now to David in Madison. David, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to tell you guys a story about my Swedish immigrant grandmother. She used to keep score of the Brooklyn Dodgers games on the radio. So when my grandfather, who was a Norwegian immigrant longshoreman, came home, he'd know exactly every single play that happened during the Brooklyn Dodgers game. And what she'd do is she would score the game, and she'd do it really lightly in pencil. And then after he had gone through the scorecard, knew exactly what happened, she erased it, and she did it again for the next Brooklyn Dodgers game.
I love that story, David. Thank you so much for calling. That's a great story. Henry, I mean, both of our callers so far have illustrated the value of this. Such an amazing personal story from each of them about this.
Absolutely, and I think it's a very strong advertisement for the for encouraging scorekeeping, whether at the ballpark or at home.
You mentioned your World Series sheet that you still have up on your wall. Any other great memories that stuck with you from a game because you kept these records?
Well, I think I must confess, there was about a 20-year gap in my scorekeeping.
Mm-hmm.
But I have my scorecard from the 1986 playoff game between the Red Sox and the Angels. I think you can tell where I'm coming from in terms of my fan loyalties. And I wish I had my Brooklyn Dodger scorecards. Those are long since have long since vanished. But certainly I regret not having them.
Now, I understand that there are apps that can do these things on tablets, on smartphones. Is that a substitute for pencil and paper?
Nothing substitutes for pencil and paper in terms of a permanency, enduringness, and the tactile sensation that you are making a record. I don't see that as a substitute, but that may again be my age speaking. And I think it's also an invitation to other distractions that may be cropping up on your smartphone or tablet. The scorecard is keeps your mind on the game, obviously, in a way that a smartphone will not. And I don't think you can hang your smartphone on the wall.
So you're still scoring games this 2013 Major League season?
I am, and I have my scorecard from my Washington Nationals game, and I'll be scoring when I go to Oakland next week and then to an Angels game the week after that. So I'm doing my bit.
Henry, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Henry Fetter. He's a blogger for The Atlantic. He's the author of Taking on the Yankees, Winning and Losing in the Business of Baseball.
Coming up next, we'll take a look at Wisconsin's aging prison population, the strain it's putting on the state, and what can be done about it. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for joining us. Stick around. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll wrap up our series on heroin in Wisconsin with a look at the growing use of special drug courts, which include addiction treatment alongside the usual crime and punishment.
We'll start things off with a related issue. Wisconsin is part of a national trend, and that is a booming growth in older prisoners.
900 of Wisconsin's 22,000 prison inmates are over 60. That's a big jump from about 10 years ago, and the number is expected to go up over time.
Stephen Richards joins us right now to talk about this trend. He is a professor of criminal justice at the University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh and a former convict himself. Professor, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
I'd like to start out with the numbers. We heard the numbers here just a few seconds ago. 900 of Wisconsin's 22,000 prison inmates now are over 60. And a couple of things. First of all, how has that changed over the years? And the second part of the question, 900 out of 22,000 doesn't sound that serious right now.
Well, it's going to get more serious because in Wisconsin, we've increased the sentences, the length of sentence that prisoners receive, and which means you've got more people going to prison who are going to be there for a longer period of time. So you're going to have more elderly, more senior citizens dying in prison.
And right now, as we look at these numbers, what are some of the challenges facing the prison system in terms of caring for some of these elderly prisoners?
Well, the Department of Corrections, you know, they've been sued. They lost a lawsuit. They were sued by ACLU a number of years ago, I believe back in 2006, having to do with the lack of medical attention for women inmates. The DOC doesn't have the money for the doctors and the nurses, and they don't have the money to provide services for prisoners. So instead, and a lot of prison systems do this, they ration what medical services they may have. They delay, deny prisoners who that prisoners don't get physicals. They don't get medical attention until they're really sick, until they've got cancer and they're dying. So if you deny or delay medical attention, it just becomes more expensive later on.
So when we start looking at numbers like that, when we start thinking about some of the implications of the medical problems that some of these elderly prisoners might be facing in the future, what sort of options are we looking at? I mean, we could dump a whole lot of money into the system, I suppose, and treat prisoners there. We could look at a way of somehow cycling elderly prisoners out of the system. Are those two options? Are there more?
Oh, there's more. I think first we have to look at simply reducing the sentences that all prisoners receive. I know the public, they don't realize it, but they hear a term like 5 or 10 years, and they don't think that's a big enough number. So instead, judges are handing out 20 and 30 and 40, and that's why the prison population is climbing and will continue to climb. So we need to reduce the prison population by simply giving shorter sentences. We need to, there's no reason why people should be doing 20 or 30 years in prison in a civilized country. I mean, if people had shorter sentences, they wouldn't be in prison when they were 60 and 70, and they wouldn't be dying in solitary confinement like they are now. So the other thing I would do is I would take a minimum security camp and convert that into a medical unit. And a lot of prisoners, both male and female, that are in maximum and medium security, these are prisoners in wheelchairs, prisoners with no legs. They're not going to run away. There's no reason to have them behind a wall or a security fence. We can move them to a medical unit at a prison camp where it would be much cheaper to provide them with the nurses and doctors that they need.
As you look around the country, I imagine other states are facing similar problems, are they?
All across the country. And what most states are doing is, and this is what happens traditionally every time you have a recession and you have budget problems, is the reality is they start releasing prisoners. And that's easy to do. I mean, it's easy to find thousands of prisoners here in Wisconsin that we could reduce without danger to the public safety. And most of these prisoners, particularly the older ones, the ones in their 50s and 60s, you know, they're tired. They've been locked up a long time. They've slowed down. They could be released without any danger of violent offenses.
But on the flip side of that, it's only going to take one incident, and you're going to be right back where you started from.
Right. That's the political issue, is that politicians are afraid of showing mercy. They're afraid of showing any kindness to convicts because they're afraid it'll backfire. Well, you know, something else backfires, too, and that is when you don't have money to pay for K-12 or pay for universities, for that matter. That backfires, too. And, I would just say that here in Wisconsin, we're spending way too much money on prisons, and we have way too many people locked up.
So one of the options you brought up before, reducing the sentences that all prisoners receive, how does that help people who are in prison now? Do we simply shorten the time that they're serving now and let them go and set them free?
It's a case-by-case. You have to look at each prisoner separately, but we should have some criteria for reducing the prison population based upon their original sentence, what percentage of that they've actually served, and what chance they have of being successful when we release them from prison. And we can do that, and that's what they do state by state all across the country.
Is there any state in particular that is doing this really right, that really has found the answer for this, or is it just a variation of letting prisoners out?
Well, right now in California, what they've been doing is having prisoners, releasing them from prison to serve some of their time in county jails, and then the state prison pays the county jail. I don't think that's the best answer. I think we need to just take the chance on each prisoner. And, yes, if you release 1,000 prisoners, you have a chance that one or two of them might, you know, rob a bank or do something that would embarrass a politician. I would argue whether you release them now or 6 months from now or a year from now, you still have the same chance. I mean, nobody does 100% of their sentence, or very few people do. So everybody really is being released early. It's just a matter of releasing them 6 months earlier.
So how do you get the public to support this idea? I think right now the prospect of releasing a lot of prisoners might not appeal to a good segment of the population.
Well, I think we have to educate the public that it's, how do you want your tax money spent? And do you really want to spend $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year to keep elderly prisoners locked up in cages. Show them pictures of prisoners in wheelchairs with no legs, prisoners that are laying in beds because they can't walk, and that's costing us $40,000-$50,000 a year per inmate.
Well, Stephen Richards, I think we'll have to leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was Stephen Richards, criminal justice professor at UW Oshkosh.
We've got a related issue coming up next on Central Time. Our heroin series concludes with a look at drug courts and their use in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Today is the last installment of our WPR news series on heroin use in Wisconsin. It's a crime, of course, to possess heroin in Wisconsin, and addicts also commit other crimes in order to support their habits. Now, for some, when they're arrested, instead of being thrown into jail, they end up in drug court. In the final installment of our heroin series, WPR's Gilman Halstead reports on the carrot-and-stick approach used by drug courts that many believe is part of the solution to the heroin epidemic.
The carrot drug courts offer is the chance to avoid being locked up and keep a felony conviction off your record. If you're accepted into the program, you have to plead guilty to a felony and attend weekly court appearances and treatment sessions and stay clean for 4 months based on weekly urine tests. If you do that, the felony's wiped off your record. It's what Dane County Drug Court Judge John Markson calls a smart approach to dealing with heroin addicts.
The theory is that their criminality is fueled by their drug addiction. And so if we can treat the addiction and remove the root cause of the problem, we're being smarter about how we deal with criminality.
The stick the judge uses is the felony hanging over the head of the heroin addict. If he violates the rules of the court too often, the charge he pled guilty to will be enforced and he'll end up in prison. And a smaller version of that stick is used throughout the program. Honesty is the key. Addicts aren't booted out of the program for using heroin as long as they don't lie about it. But if they challenge a positive drug test, they face a jail sanction. Here's Judge Markson doing just that to a participant who was set to graduate from the program in 2 weeks, but challenged his most recent positive drug test.
What's going on?
Nothing is going on. I'm not using. I
need to do something to wake you up to the realities of where we're at.
Okay, so you want me to lose my job?
That's enough. Your 2-night jail sanction starts now. We'll see you back here next week. Wow is right, and we'll deal with it. In fact, that's the third night. That's a 3-night sanction for the
Judge Martin, please.
Out 3 nights.
Immediate punitive sanctions like this on addicts work, according to supporters of drug courts, and the statistics bear it out. Nationally, 75% of drug court graduates don't commit any new crimes in the first 2 years following their completion of the program. But positive reinforcement is also key, and drug court participants get that each week they remain clean and a lot of praise when they graduate. Here's Judge Markson erasing 27-year-old Jamie Burkhalter's heroin possession charges.
As a result of what you've done in the program, you have earned the dismissal of those charges. So that's a real big deal, and you should be very proud of what you've done in that regard.
Burkhalter himself says it was counselors at the treatment center the court sent him to and the support of his girlfriend that helped him kick the habit.
I tried to quit numerous times. And it's going to continue to be a struggle. I'd probably be literally dead or in prison if it wasn't for her.
Another drug court graduate, Patrick Kempfer, has now been clean for 4 years. He says the addicts the program works for have to accept what it offers at face value and move on with their lives.
They want people to come in and by the time they leave, not be an issue for society. They want you to respect your life enough to not throw it away, to not go to criminal activity, to not waste it using drugs, because they are aware that each using addict is like a little nuclear bomb that goes off and creates devastation in every direction. They're trying to minimize that by giving people an opportunity to care about their life.
Gilman Halstead, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And thanks for that story, Gilman.
Here with us now to discuss the techniques and outcomes of drug courts is Doug Marlowe, Chief of Science, Law, and Policy for the National Association of Drug Court Professionals. Doug, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we just heard that report on drug courts and how they work in Wisconsin. Is this something that's really catching on around the country?
Oh, there are currently over 2,700 drug courts in the U.S., and there are drug courts in about 30 other countries. About 50% of counties in the U.S. have a drug court, so it is rapidly becoming the way of doing business in the criminal justice system.
And is this a case where I'm in the criminal justice system in this county here and I see this thing working somewhere else? Are people getting a lot of good word of mouth on the outcomes of these?
Oh, absolutely. There's been more research on drug courts than any other program in the criminal justice system. And the result of those positive outcomes has been more and more counties, you know, wanting to develop the model, looking for federal and state funding to develop their own models. So it's definitely spreading.
Now, we just heard from Gilman how these things work, but what is it that makes them work? What is the what's behind their success?
For the last many decades, there has been a false dichotomy between punishing people for their drug addiction and treating them, between focusing on public health or public safety, treatment or punishment. And drug courts have basically said it's both. We are going to hold people accountable for their actions. There are going to be consequences, but we're going to use the power of the criminal justice system to keep people in treatment and get them the services they need. And so, like you said before, it's the carrot and the stick is the magic formula.
Were these a hard sell when they first came along because of that sentiment that you mentioned that this is a system about punishment first and foremost?
Well, I think in the early years, in the late 80s and early 90s, they were seen as being, you know, sort of soft on crime and sort of like a hug-a-thug kind of a program. Nowadays, I think they're pretty much recognized as a very substantial type program. People are not getting a free break. They are being held accountable. Programs are actually pretty tough on people. People are supervised very closely. There's real accountability. So I think that criticism has pretty much faded over the last couple of decades.
I want to key in on a word you've used a couple few times now, accountable and accountability.
Right.
I've read in the past that not only does the public appreciate that idea and the courts themselves, but actually the people being charged actually get some buy-in when they're held accountable. Does the research back that up?
Absolutely. I mean, the most common thing you'll see at a drug court graduation is the offender thanking the officer that arrested them or thanking the prosecutor that, you know, tried to hold them accountable. They can't do it themselves. Addiction is a loss of control. People cannot make the right decisions. Their judgment's impaired. They're led by that drug. They need the external power, the leverage to hold them, and they really appreciate it.
Now, we've been talking about heroin over the course of the last week here in our WPR news series. How common are heroin and other opiates showing up in the drug courts?
Oh, I'd say that's probably the most fast-growing drug in drug courts. The prescription opiate epidemic is really growing mm-hmm. in this country, and a lot of people are becoming addicted to prescription opiates, and then when they can't afford them or can't get them anywhere, they're moving to street heroin. And so I would say that's probably the drug that's rising the most.
Now, maybe I'm naive, but I guess I've always assumed that if I'm sent to prison for drug use and I'm addicted, I'm going to get some kind of treatment in prison. Does that happen at all?
Most people will not receive treatment in prison. The percentage of people that actually get treatment in prison is fairly small. In many prisons, the quality of the service is not very good. And basically, the average effects of treatment in prison are really very minimal. The important time is when the individual is back on the street, coming in contact with the people that are using, with the drugs, with the stresses of their lives. And so if you give them treatment in prison and then release them, they're going to return to drug use pretty rapidly. And they don't even go back to using drugs at the same rate as before they entered prison. They will usually use it at a higher rate after a period of incarceration. So the critical period is the time in the community.
Do we have a sense, numbers-wise, how it compares a heroin addict, say, who goes to prison, doesn't go through a drug court, versus a heroin addict who goes through a drug court? What's the difference in likelihood that they're going to relapse and get addicted again?
Almost everybody returning from prison is going to relapse. I mean, it's like 85%
wow.
within the first 30 to 90 days, and it's 95% in a year. in drug courts, you know, I mean, on average, you're going to get a 15, 20, 25% reduction in relapse rates, you know, just in the first year. And then that usually grows from there. In terms of reducing crime, you know, some drug courts are cutting crime rates in half. Now, of course, there's a lot of drug courts out there. Not all are as effective as others. But on average, drug courts are cutting crime rates and cutting drug use 15 to 20%. You can take that to the bank.
And just in our last 30 seconds or so, are states policymakers looking at this and saying this is a good investment?
Oh, there are several states where the governor, legislature, and Supreme Court have all gotten together and said there shall be a drug court in every county, and not always the states that you might expect. States like, you know, Alabama and Georgia and Texas, drug courts as well as New Jersey. Drug courts are really catching on, and they're really being spread throughout the country.
Doug, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Doug Marlow. He's chief of science, law, and policy for the National Association of Drug Court Professionals.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll be talking about the war on cancer and why we seem to be losing it.
We'll also hear from a former inmate who spent 44 years in prison, 12 in solitary confinement, about why prisoners start protesting against the prison system.
And a former director for the U.S. Census Bureau will tell us how the census gets it wrong when it comes to classifying race in America.
That's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time.